Hi, welcome to this week's program. Remember the first time you heard about the stock market? I'm sure it got the adrenaline up for many of you, excited about picking stocks, with dreams of doubling, tripling, or 10xing your money. The early days when you hadn't tasted your first loss of capital and you were completely unaware of the dangerous pitfalls of inexperienced, untrained, and overconfident investing. It's almost like a rite of passage where the market quickly hazes newbies and shows them that it's the one that's all powerful. So, for those of you who are new to investing, let me give you some tips on how you can keep from getting burned by the market. First, now the basics of investing sound really simple in theory. Buy low, sell high, that's it. How hard can that be? Well, you'll be surprised. To make money with a simple strategy, first you have to know what low and high really mean. And remember, in the stock market, when you buy, someone else is selling. And when you sell, someone else is buying. So what you may think as high as a seller of shares would probably be considered low enough for the buyer in that transaction. So are you really smarter than your anonymous counterparty? See what I mean? How different conclusions can be drawn from the same information. So because of this hard to pin down relative nature of the market, it's important to study a bit before jumping in because it's really never as simple as buy low and sell high. I always say that investing is simple, but it's not easy. So before you start investing on your own, I do believe you should read up on basic accounting so you understand terms like revenue and revenue growth, operating expenses, operating margins, operating profit, earnings per share, you know, stuff that's on the company's income statement. And you need to know about the balance sheet as well, the terms like cash and total assets and total liabilities, current liabilities, book value, those kinds of terms. You also want to understand terms like working capital and cash flow, so you're in a slightly better position to truly assess a company's financial position before you jump on someone's recommendation to buy a hot stock. You also need to know about price-to-earnings ratios and so on. You have to understand how they get calculated and what their major weaknesses are. Very important when you compare a company's stock valuation relative to its fundamentals, relative to its competitors or the market as a whole. And while you're learning, it's always good to start out by using virtual money in a stock simulator. Most likely, you'll find that the market is much more complex than a few ratios can express, but learning those and testing them in a demo account can help lead you to the next level of study. Let's talk about playing penny stocks and fads. You know, at first glance, penny stocks, which literally cost less than a dollar per share, seem like a great idea to invest in. With as little as $100, you can get a lot more shares of penny stock than the popular companies like Facebook or Google, right? And you may be tempted by a sizable upside if a penny stock goes to a dollar. But remember, a penny stock is a penny stock for a reason. The market doesn't believe the company warrants a higher valuation, and the company may not offer much future gain. So what penny stocks offer in position size and potential profitability may reflect high volatility and really poor expected returns. So even if you buy a stock for 50 cents, because it's more highly volatile, you can end up losing your entire 50 cents should the company tank. And that risk is much less with stocks of large companies. And penny stocks are also exceptionally vulnerable to manipulation. You know, getting solid information on penny stocks can be very difficult because many reputed investment companies simply do not follow them, making penny stocks a poor choice for an investor who is still learning. So beware. Penny stock pushers would love to con you into thinking that they're the path to riches, and while that's true extremely rarely, most of the time people have lost big on penny trades. As a matter of fact, on social media, I now see ads for the promise of making millions on penny stocks of companies involved in the commercialization of marijuana. You know, there's no easy riches, and most who get into this are going to lose everything. And it's been said, there's a sucker born every minute. So overall, I prefer you own a quality stock for a long time than try to make a quick buck on a low-quality company. We're talking about the dangers of investing, especially for first-time investors. Here's another one. Investing 100% of your capital in a specific investment is usually not a good move, even with a Google, a Microsoft, or a Facebook, because even the best companies can face issues down the road and see their shares decline dramatically. While you might have more upside if you go all in and the company does really well, you'll also have a lot more risk, especially as a first-time investor. It's good to diversify and buy at least a handful of stocks. This way, the lessons learned along the way are less costly, but still valuable. You know, it's been said that investing or learning about investing costs money. Either you go to school and you learn it, either you hire an advisor and have a professional do it, or you do it yourself and lose quite a bit of money. And usually that third choice is the most expensive of the three. Here's another dangerous move is leveraging your money by using margin. Using margin means that you borrow money from your broker to buy more stock than you can afford. Using leverage magnifies both the gains and losses on your investment. So here's an example. Let's say you have $100 and you borrow $50, so you buy $150 worth of stock. Stock rises 10%, you make $15. $15 on $150. But that $15 is actually $15 on $100, which is a 15% return on capital. Pretty good, right? Now, if the stock declines 10%, you lose $15 or for a 15% loss, even though the stock only declined 10. More importantly, if the stock goes up by 50%, you make a 75% rate of return. That's pretty good. But if the stock declines by 50%, you're left with $75. Now, from that $75, you got to pay back the $50 that you borrowed. That leaves you with just $25. That's a whopping 75% loss of invested capital. So as a new investor, make sure you don't get lured by the siren song of margin and its potential for higher rates of return. Now, talking about investing cash you can't afford to lose is another dangerous move. Studies have shown that cash put into the market in bulk rather than incrementally may provide a better overall return. But this doesn't mean that you should invest your whole nest egg at one time. Investing is a long-term business, and staying in business requires having cash on the sidelines for emergencies and opportunities. Sure, cash on the sidelines doesn't earn any returns, but having all your cash in the market is a risk that even professional investors won't take. If you don't have a lot of free cash beyond your emergency cash reserves, really, stay out of the market. Putting all your money on the line makes you emotionally vulnerable and leads to investing with what is called a behavioral bias. It's a handicap, which almost predisposes you to making bad decisions. So only invest money that you can truly afford to leave in the market for long periods of time. All right, finally, whether it's trying to guess which stock will be the next Apple, investing quickly in a hot stock tip, or going all in on a rumor of earth-shaking earnings, investing on new tips is a terrible move for first-time investors. Remember, you're competing with professional firms that not only get information the second it becomes available, but also know how to properly analyze a company's performance before it announces results. Rather than following rumors, ideal first investments are companies that you understand and have a personal experience dealing with. As good as Warren Buffett is, he always invests in what he calls his circle of competence, meaning he sticks to what he knows and what he understands, and you should do the same. So remember, when you're personally buying stocks in the market, you're competing against large mutual funds and institutional investors that not only do this full-time, but also have far more resources and in-depth information than the average person. Temper your expectations, start small, take measured risks with your money, with the money that you're prepared to lose, and then after you read up and become more adept at evaluating stocks, start making bigger investments. While it's tempting to bet the bank to try to make a quick buck, real money is made by slowly compounding your returns over several decades of disciplined investing. There's little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. Add the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we have entrusted our savings, and it adds stress and uneasiness to our lives. Because of the ongoing and ever-changing nature of today's turbulence, we have decided, due to popular demand and to meet the schedule needs of our listeners, to hold an early evening live event. So here's what I'll cover. You know, everyone wants to know whether we've seen an end to the 10-year-old bull market. Some say yes, others say no. What are you supposed to do under those circumstances? Come join me to find out. Not only are the markets volatile, but the daily degree of the rise and fall can be very unsettling. And if volatility is here to stay, I'll discuss how to handle it. What if markets keep going down or stay down and earn no return next year? Is there a way to increase your income in the meantime from your investments and savings? I'll show you techniques to help boost your return on savings, increase your cash flow, reduce your taxes, and more. You see, I want to make sure you live your one best financial life, and I want to help you get the information you need to get it right. I'll show you some of the tools we use to get you on track and to help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com to reserve a seat for Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Whitney Tilson is the founder of Case Learning, an educational platform offering programs for people interested in becoming better investors and launching and building successful investment management businesses. Whitney has also co-authored two well-regarded books about investing and ran his own hedge fund and produces a newsletter that is always fascinating to read. Now, I first noticed Whitney at the Berkshire annual meeting in Omaha, where year after year, he had this uncanny ability to get to the microphone to ask Warren and Charlie Munger a question. So I contacted him and found out a lot about him, and he's been on the show a few times. Welcome to the show, Whitney.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Good to be back.
My first question for you has to do with the business results and subsequent comments made by Warren Buffett after the release of his most recent annual report. And my question is simply, should investors continue to bet on Warren Buffett? But before you answer, let me go through a short list that I made, and we'll start with Heinz. Now, if you follow Warren Buffett at all, you know that Heinz, he admitted, was a big misstep. Heinz took a $15 billion write-down on their core brands of Kraft and Oscar Mayer. There's an SEC investigation into their accounting practices, which may require a restating of several years' worth of earnings. They've cut their dividend 36%, and their cash flow guidance projects a 10% decline for the upcoming year. So, Whitney, what happened with Heinz?
Well, it's a complicated story, and it's important to note here, by the way, that this has not been a bad investment for Berkshire Hathaway. It was a spectacular investment, and now that the stock has been hammered, it's turned into sort of an investment where Buffett doubled his money instead of, you know, made five or six times his money. So this is an investment where Buffett backed three Brazilian guys with a group called 3G that acquired Kraft and then Heinz and combined them into this Kraft-Heinz company today. And they are big cost cutters, and their cost cutting appears to have been overdone. They probably, you know, they cut out a lot of fat, and they're very good at that. But it appears like they also cut into muscle and bone. And so that combined with general struggles across the consumer packaged goods industry has really led Kraft Heinz's results to suffer. And the stock, which got way ahead of itself, has really come back in a lot. So I don't think Buffett considers this the overall investment a mistake, or at least the initial investment. It was done as a two-step investment. And he acknowledges they probably overpaid for the second piece of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure Buffett's not real happy about it right now. But, you know, keep in mind that, you know, Berkshire has almost a $500 billion market cap. And this, you know, represents only a few percent of Berkshire's value.
Yeah. One investment does not mean that he's lost his touch. But when you look at further comments from him, and he spoke, Becky Quick from CNBC interviewed him, and he spoke about his top managers, Todd Coombs and Ted Wexler, and Buffett himself not outperforming the S&P 500, coupled with frequent statements made by Buffett that index fund investing is superior, seems to lead credence to this idea that beating the S&P is extremely difficult. And if Buffett and his two expert managers are having trouble doing it, why should we bet on Berkshire Hathaway?
Yeah, well, look, by the way, I agree with his general advice that most people will be very well served by just sticking to a super low fee index fund, like, you know, the Vanguard S&P 500 fund, for example. That's, in fact, Buffett has said that when he passes away, he owns money outside of Berkshire. He has assets outside of his Berkshire stock, but that 80% will be indexed to the S&P and 20% will be in cash upon his demise. So the question is why Berkshire, I think, will outperform the S&P. And I think it's because it's probably 20% undervalued today. It's an incredible business run by the world's greatest investor. But you should have realistic expectations. Berkshire is not a get-rich stock. It's a stay-rich stock. And so I think it's likely to outperform the S&P by a few percentage points a year. So, you know, I've got, you know, my parents, for example, who are in their late 70s, are mostly in index funds, but they own some Berkshire as well, because I think there's a decent chance. I'd say there's a 75% chance that over the next 5 or 10 years, Berkshire will outperform the S&P 500.
Well, you mentioned that it's selling at a 20% discount to its intrinsic value, or some valuation similar to that. So that in of itself, even if the portfolio of businesses produces a return similar to the S&P 500, if at any time that gap closes, that 20% discount closes, there could be some possibility for outperformance?
Well, I think you win in two ways with Berkshire. Berkshire's intrinsic value, which Berkshire is a collection of, you know, 75 operating businesses, and then it's a stock and bond, an investment portfolio. And I think both pieces of Berkshire, but particularly the operating businesses, are doing really very well. And so I think intrinsic value is growing in the high single digits. And so if the stock merely tracks the growth of Berkshire's intrinsic value, then I think you'll do better than the S&P 500, which I expect would compound, you know, given that it's pretty close to all-time highs today. I think realistically, in a U.S. economy growing a low single-digit GDP growth, you might expect mid-single-digit growth in the S&P 500 over the next 5 to 10 years. I think you should have very realistic expectations there. So if Berkshire's intrinsic value is compounding in the high single digits, that's going to beat the S&P 500, assuming the stock tracks that. And then I think you win in a second way if the gap to Berkshire's intrinsic value closes somewhat. I peg intrinsic value at about $363,000 per A share. The stock is at $305 today. So that's a 16% discount to intrinsic value today.
Of course, as a warning to investors, discounts can stay around for very, very long periods of time just because something is selling below intrinsic.
And they can widen.
And they can widen as well, as we all know. So I was wondering if part of the problem was the fact that prices have been, for stocks that Warren wants to buy, have been a little high for the last number of years. And so he has not made any really big purchases. And so there's a huge cash buildup, $112 billion at last counting, 34.6% of the value of the portfolio is in cash. I was wondering whether this was a typical late cycle effect of Buffett's strategy, and in that he won't overpay for stocks or just be in stocks for the sake of being in stocks. And during a late cycle or long bull markets, he'll tend to underperform near the end. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Buffett has been very upfront that it's around the world, but it's not 100%, but he's mostly looking in the United States, though he's really making an effort to try and find things to buy overseas as well. But it's primarily U.S. focused, and with the market, I mean, he's looking to buy two things. Keep in mind, he's got, you know, well over $100 billion of excess cash he's looking to put to work, but it's a high-class problem. He has well over $1 billion a month pouring into Omaha from the profits of the operating businesses. So it's a problem, a high-class problem, but it's a problem that's getting worse. The cash keeps piling up, and he has not done any major acquisitions. He's looking to do two things: buy stocks, publicly traded securities, and also buy private companies. Like the last big deal was Precision Castparts 3 years ago. But he also bought years ago Burlington Northern, was one of the biggest deals ever. So he really prefers buying private businesses and owning them outright. But the problem is in both areas where he can invest, the stock market and buying private companies, the prices are high. There's a lot of competition and he's not going to overpay. And I respect that discipline, but it does mean that that cash does act as an anchor on Berkshire. So I do think Berkshire is more likely to outperform the S&P in a flat to down market than in a strong bull market. But keep in mind, over the last 10 years, we just a couple days ago passed the 10-year anniversary of the bottom of the bear market in March of 2009. Over that time period, the S&P 500 exactly quadrupled with dividends reinvested. And Berkshire Hathaway, despite being, has done exactly the same. Yeah. It's also quadrupled. Yeah. So you might say, well, why do you like the stock if it hasn't beaten the market over a 10-year period? And the answer is that the fact that a very cash-rich, conservatively financed company, much, much safer than the average company, is keeping up in one of the strongest bull markets in history, I think is a real testament to what a great stock it is. But it's a sleep well at night stock. I think where it would really shine is in a down market.
We'll be back with Whitney Tilson as he gives us some insights on how to actually calculate the value of a company like Berkshire Hathaway. Stay tuned. There's little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. Add the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we entrust our savings, and it adds stress and uneasiness to our lives. Because of the ongoing and ever-changing nature of today's market volatility, we have decided, due to popular demand and to meet the schedule needs of our listeners, to hold an early evening live event Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. That's at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m., the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. We were having some technical difficulties there, so we called Whitney back and we are now on his cell phone. So you may hear a little bit different quality, but it's the same discussion, same guy, same two guys talking and trying to figure things out. My guest is Whitney Tilson. He's the founder of Case Learning. He's owned and operated his own hedge funds, and he's very, very familiar with Berkshire Hathaway. And talking about Berkshire Hathaway, Whitney, how did you get to this intrinsic value number? It's such a huge company, and a lot of those companies are private.
Yes. There's a complex answer, but I'm going to give you a very simple answer because I don't think complexity really helps here. The way you value any company is you look at the cash or the cash equivalents that you would be buying if you bought the company, and then you put a multiple on the earnings of the business. And Berkshire lends itself beautifully. It has a great big portfolio of cash, bonds, and stocks that you just value at their current market value. And that gets you to about $195,000 per A share. And then the company generates $14,000 a share of operating earnings. I put a 12 multiple on that. And that gets you, when you combine those two, it gets you to about $364,000 per A share. And the stock today is trading at around 304, 305. So it's about a 16, 17% discount to intrinsic value, the way we calculate it. But keep in mind, intrinsic value is a range.
Yeah.
You know, reasonable people could come up with somewhat different numbers, but Berkshire actually isn't that hard to value.
It's interesting because this idea of valuation is one of the most important factors in investing. And so many things are difficult to value. For example, when you talk about gold, gold doesn't throw off any cash. It actually costs money to store and hold. And yet it has some kind of a current value. But if someone said, what is the intrinsic value of something like gold or something like Bitcoin? I think someone would be hard pressed to say it's worth X in reality. When you're dealing with companies that throw off cash flow, you can kind of figure out rates of return and intrinsic value will follow from that. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I would put Bitcoin at one extreme. It is impossible to value. Gold is somewhere out there in that part of the spectrum, though gold does have some industrial uses, right, et cetera. And then at the other extreme would be something that's very quite straightforward, like Berkshire Hathaway, where you can add up the cash, the bonds, the stocks, and put a multiple on the earnings of the operating businesses, and you can come up with a pretty tight range of intrinsic value.
So I want to get back to this idea that we've just passed the 10th anniversary of the day that stocks bottomed during the Great Recession. Now, for those of us, you and I, and others who lived through that as an investor, you write that it's hard to convey the degree of total panic at the time. Bring us back to March of 2009 and the quarter before then, and what really we were experiencing and how difficult it was to even think that, you know, the markets and the economy was going to continue on.
Yeah, it was a period of just incredible panic. It was the biggest stock market decline since the Great Depression. And the financial system had effectively frozen up. And there were so many causes and so many pieces of this. But let me see if I can sort of summarize it in a way your listeners will understand. Any country, any modern economy's lifeblood is its financial system, its banking system. And keep in mind that debt markets are much larger than equity markets or stock markets, right? But debt investors are very conservative and they do not expect to ever take any loss of principal, right?
Right.
And what happened was lenders went crazy. And the world's largest debt market is the U.S. mortgage market. But the craziness was not limited there. It infected, you know, commercial mortgages and all types of debt. And then to make matters worse, people made a lot of side bets through exotic derivatives like credit default swaps,
yeah,
where, you know, investors could see that the major financial institutions had big exposures and big losses and had made big mistakes. But what really freaked people out is every day, it seemed, there were new reports of off-balance sheet liabilities and losses that investors didn't know about. And that created real fear and panic. And so basically, banks no longer trusted each other. And the entire financial system, for a matter of days anyway, particularly when Lehman went bankrupt, almost ground to a halt. And it took the U.S. government, the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, the world's largest economy, accounts for 23% of the world's GDP, basically had to come in and backstop not just the U.S. financial system, but the global financial system, because it wasn't just the U.S. banks that were seizing up. So it was a time of real panic. And, you know, I think Buffett said it was as if the patient was having a heart attack,
right,
and it was in cardiac arrest. And, you know, thank goodness the U.S. government came in and basically bailed everybody out, you know, which left a unpleasant taste in a lot of people's mouths. But I assure you, if your credit card stopped working and you went to the bank, to the ATM to withdraw cash from your account, and it said you can't have your cash,
right,
that's what we were literally facing. We were within days of that kind of outcome.
Yeah, I remember that. Also, there's this old saying that if you see a line forming around a bank, join it.
Yeah.
But that aside, investing during that period of time, you mentioned one particular stock that was selling for around $8 a share, and it was selling at a big discount to your calculation as to what it was worth. But just because it was cheap didn't mean it couldn't go cheaper, and it ended up going to $2 a share. Living through that and the self-doubt that comes with this idea that you can't absolutely be sure that you're making the right decision, what did that feel like then?
Yeah, I could see that stocks were cheap, and I just had confidence that the government would do what was necessary to prevent a total collapse. And so I was buying stocks as they fell, but every day, everything I bought the previous day opened up cheaper the next day. And stocks that I bought that were $0.50 became $0.40, and then $0.30 and $0.20. So that particular stock you mentioned, a specialty chemical company called Huntsman, was a good business, but it had debt. And anything that had debt at the time, normally when debt comes due, companies could just roll it, but not when financial markets have seized up. So the fear was that Huntsman would be forced into bankruptcy and the shareholders would be wiped out. And so a stock that was easily worth $15, there had been a buyout offer at $26 a year earlier, but was trading at $8. And so I thought I was buying a 50-cent dollar, and I was. But that didn't prevent the stock a few months later from going as low as $2 a share. And then it went to $20 in less than 2 years. So I was right about the intrinsic value. But psychologically, it was brutal. Lose 75% of my money in just a few months.
But then the market turned, and you write, in your wildest dreams, could you have imagined that 10 years ago, the sentiment would change so quickly that investors would be willing to put their money at risk and see the S&P 500 quadruple from that low. But the story's not over there, because you write in your newsletter that there were some serious mistakes that you made on the way up. And I'd like to address those as well, just to kind of give people an idea that this idea of investing is simple, but it's not easy. So let's talk about three mistakes that you write about. You turned cautious way too soon. You trimmed, then exited positions that you should have held. And then you write, most painfully, Netflix. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Basically, I played the downturn really quite well. I didn't nail the bottom to the exact day, but you know, that stock that went from 8 to 6 to 4 to 2, I bought all the way down and made a fortune when it went to 20. So I predicted the downturn reasonably well. I started buying down near the bottom, made a ton of money in the first year or two coming out of the downturn. But then I turned cautious, and that was a big mistake. I did not foresee a 10-year bull market. I did not foresee investors who had just been in absolute panic within a year or two becoming complacent and embracing risk. So I played defense. I positioned my fund for a storm that never came. Mm. And so that meant that I was holding a lot of cash. It meant that I was shorting stocks. In addition to owning stocks, I was hoping they would go up. I shorted companies that I thought where the stocks would go down. And of course, pretty much every stock has been going up in the last decade.
Right.
So that was costly. And then even when I had some of the greatest stocks of the decade, like Netflix, which went up 50 times from its lows, I owned Netflix. And not only did I own it, I pitched it at a conference and on national television the day that it hit its low.
Mm-hmm.
And I still made 7 times my money. That was great. But making 7 times your money on a stock that ends up going up 50 times isn't so great.
Yeah.
So the lessons here are, generally, I think most investors would be well served to not, you know, read all the hysterical headlines every day in the newspapers and in the internet, people predicting market calamities or whatever.
Right.
Just stick to index funds. You know, every year, if you spend less than you earn, therefore you are saving, and take those savings, the long-term money that you don't need anytime in the next year or two, and just consistently put that money into index funds and just ignore the market and ignore the prognosticators. You know, I tried to be too smart. I tried to have an opinion on the market when really what I'm good at is just picking stocks like Berkshire Hathaway and like Netflix. Had I just stuck to my knitting and not tried to, you know, have some big market opinion, I would have done a lot better.
Danger in being too smart and not staying humble in light of what's so hard to know the actual future. My guest, Whitney Tilson, founder of Case Learning, which is an educational platform that he's offering now for people interested in becoming better investors and launching their own investment management businesses, co-author of 2 books, very well regarded in the investment industry. Whitney, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So to hear this interview again, or any interview that we do, if you have any question about what we've just discussed, we'd love to get your questions. Visit our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics that we've covered this week straight to your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. There's little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. Add the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we have entrusted our savings, and it adds stress and uneasiness to our lives. Because of the ongoing and ever-changing nature of today's turbulence, we have decided, due to popular demand and to meet the schedule needs of our listeners, to hold an early evening live event. So here's what I'll cover. You know, everyone wants to know whether we've seen an end to the 10-year-old bull market. Some say yes, others say no. What are you supposed to do under those circumstances? Come join me to find out. Not only are the markets volatile, but the daily degree of the rise and fall can be very unsettling. And if volatility is here to stay, I'll discuss how to handle it. What if markets keep going down or stay down and earn no return next year? Is there a way to increase your income in the meantime from your investments and savings? I'll show you techniques to help boost your return on savings, increase your cash flow, reduce your taxes, and more. You see, I want to make sure you live your one best financial life, and I want to help you get the information you need to get it right. I'll show you some of the tools we use to get you on track and to help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com to reserve a seat for Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
There was an article about how much housing prices have improved since the Great Recession. Take us there.
Yeah, you know, the average median home value has increased by nearly $50,000 across all 50 states, 50 largest metro
On average,
since 2009.
And you see that in your area, right?
No question.
Palm Beach County.
No question.
Broward County.
We've already gone back to 2006.
Yeah.
And in some areas exceeded that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Unfortunately, there are some areas of the country that have seen depreciation. It really amazes me to hear this.
Yeah.
Name a few.
So we're looking at Hartford, Connecticut, Chicago, Virginia Beach, and Baltimore.
Now, I'm surprised about Chicago, quite frankly, being in an urban area and the like. It's such a great city. But for some reason, median housing prices have fallen there since 2009.
Yeah.
Now, in California, as expected, they've seen a huge jump in prices.
Oh, I know. It's crazy. So you're talking an average of $243,000.
That's an average.
I know. That's crazy.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
A lot of money. You better make a lot of money.
And you have to make a lot of money to live in California.
Yeah.
And to get a small, simple house starts at $1 million.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, not every...
Well, they should move to
like
Florida.
Like San Francisco.
You know.
Just move to Florida with everybody else.
I know. That's
Have you noticed
want.
The streets getting busier?
Oh.
They're all here.
Yeah. I wish they'd go. In Florida, Miami ranks number 15. Average house is $51,300 higher, which is 22.6%.
That's a nice increase.
Orlando is $27,000. Which is 14% higher. Tampa's 25,000, which is 15% higher. And then Jacksonville is 20,000, which is about 10% higher. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there's always these surveys that you guys do, the NAHB or National...
NAHB, yes.
Yeah, National Association of...
We love our surveys.
Okay. You love your surveys. That's what I was going to get to. So, of course, you know, they're asking questions like, what's your favorite upgrade? And so they asked, what buyers want, what are the top 2019 top features that people are looking for? And the top feature, it's just as a guy, and I get this, but the top feature was a laundry room.
Yeah, you know, I get the laundry room. It kills me because I hear I'm upgrading my house right now.
Yeah.
I don't have a laundry room. So the first item on here says laundry room, and I think, oh my God, I better not more money into my house because I don't have a laundry room.
You need the laundry room. Well,
I don't know. I don't spend that much time in the laundry room. Actually, I don't even do my laundry
there
if somebody
go.
Do it. But that's another story. But really, I mean, is it that big of a deal?
I think a laundry room is a big deal. I really do.
Yeah.
I think, you know, first of all,
What's wrong with a closet with the washer and dryer
I see.
You know, you just...
Yeah, but you need a place to fold and
do it in front of the TV.
Yeah.
You put the laundry in a basket, right? Like our parents did, and they sat there with the ironing watching soap operas.
If you're not doing your laundry, you're not ironing. So
no,
I don't know who you're talking about.
It took a long time before my kids realized, what's that, mommy?
What is that brick doing on that table? On
exactly.
That, okay.
So the other thing they want is energy-saving features, which I get.
You know, sure.
We all want to lower our costs on their appliances and windows and whole house certifications saying that it has all these features.
They also want, and everyone needs this, as a guy can tell you, they want storage.
Yeah, I got
okay,
the storage.
I want storage in my garage, okay?
Right. And walk-in pantries.
Those are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hardwood flooring.
But not so much down here. We're into tile. Tile that looks like hardwood flooring.
Oh, yeah. I know. Those look pretty good, too.
They're nice.
Yeah. Okay.
I like them.
All right. And then patio and exterior lighting. But with all of this, changing the subject, but keeping it somewhat similar, housing footprint, the size of homes that people are buying getting smaller.
Yes. The McMansions back in the...
those are gone.
God. Who needs all that space?
I know.
It's a lot of cleaning.
Yeah.
Anyway, the footprint is decreasing. The new home starts declined. The average is close to 2,600 square feet.
Yeah.
And today, down from closer to 27. So it's about 100
square feet less. But really, when you look at these statistics, they're not straightforward because
right.
the reason it's declining is that there's been more demand for townhomes.
Right. And then you say, well, why townhomes? Well, it's not that they favor townhomes, but they want to be closer to the cities and the urban areas. And the land is more valuable the closer you get to the city centers. So the opportunity to build townhomes is greater now.
Yeah, it's greater.
In those areas.
But new homes, regular homes, have been downsizing since 2016. Fewer have more than four bedrooms or three or more bathrooms. And it shows that builders are trying to respond to the crisis around housing affordability. Suburbs are still the most desirable place to live, 64% according to that survey.
Yep.
Rural settings, 24%, and central city, 11%. And millennials are mostly central city type.
Right. They
folks,
like to walk to downtown and restaurants and that sort of thing.
That's very cool. Okay. You're involved in this area quite a bit. The home gets sold, prices agreed upon, and then the home inspector comes in and messes everything up.
Bum, 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 bum.
So there was a study of 50,000 home inspections.
Yep.
And here's some of the numbers that they found. Top 10 common home defects.
Okay, I think a lot of these are really silly, but a door needs adjusting and a servicing. Okay.
I could do that.
I know, I could do that. Faucet and heads need servicing.
Okay.
That means they're
water's
not flowing properly or dripping.
Yeah.
Exterior caulking and sealant missing. Now, that's common, and that's kind of important, especially if you don't want water intrusion.
In Florida, especially.
Yeah. Keep an eye out on these. Outlets and switches with deficiencies. No GFCI protection. So that's that ground fault protection.
Yeah,
so
a little
doohickey that pops out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah, sure. You know,
especially
won't get electrocuted.
Kids.
Yeah, absolutely. So getting those switched out. Absence of or defective smoke alarms.
Yeah.
Cosmetic sheetrock cracks and nail pops, fixtures and bulb deficiencies. If you're going to sell your house, please put in new light bulbs. Caulking,
wait, stop, stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, freshen up your light bulbs so things are shiny and
so they can
blasting.
See all the. Right?
Yeah, okay. No, that's one of those little things. I never would have thought to do that.
Yeah, especially with all these high hats and these 10-foot, 12-foot, 20-foot ceilings.
Yeah,
it's difficult to change those light bulbs out. So a lot of people just ignore them. So the inspector says, "Oh, that light must be broken because
it couldn't be
the light bulb."
I got you. He can't get up there and
screw. And he can't. Right.
All right, real quickly because we're running out of time.
Yep.
The most expensive repairs found.
Yes.
Roof nearing end of its serviceable life. Well, we all know that. Here, they're putting the price to repair about $10,000. I think that's low.
It's very low.
Yeah. Coil and condenser for your air conditioner, that's about $5,800. I think that's about right.
That's for a new one.
That's for a new one. Heating unit, forget that. Water heater needs replaced, $1,200. And window seals failed or fogged, don't really know what that means, $1,000 to repair.
It must be something up north.
Yeah, exactly. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
There's little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. Add the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we entrust our savings, and it adds stress and uneasiness to our lives. Because of the ongoing and ever-changing nature of today's market volatility, we have decided, due to popular demand and to meet the schedule needs of our listeners, to hold an early evening live event Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. That's at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m., the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I want to bring back one of my colleagues. His name is Rick Ditter. He's a senior wealth manager with United Capital. And today we're going to talk about manipulative sales techniques. Hey, Rick, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Steve. Might I add, you're looking particularly sharp today. Did you get a new suit? You look like you're at least 10 years younger.
All right, Rick. What's going on here? You know, the last time I wish moves like that, someone was trying to sell me a timeshare.
Yeah, you and I talked about some of the most egregious sales practices going around today, especially in the financial services industry, and I wanted to talk about them. You know, Steve, there are so many ways that people are manipulated that I thought I'd bring some of these to light.
Yeah, you know, I agree. This is a great topic that people need to pay attention to. It's incredibly important, and it's been a mission on my show since beginning 19 years ago to bring these things to light. Okay, so we're going to have some fun today. So give me an extreme example of one of these sales pitches.
Well, I know you've heard something like this. Well, you got your 12-volt battery, half-inch keyless chuck, bullseye laser, never slip grip, 30-day free trial, and I'm going to throw in a second battery for free. And if you buy it now, I'll knock $50 off the price. Look, Steve, you're a smart guy. I'm sure you can see why you need one. So the real question is not what you're going to buy, but what color.
So I recognize that. This is the sham wow guy, right? This is the guy standing behind the counter, and he's pitching me hard. And I think he's using some sales techniques that I've recognized here, but I'm not exactly sure what they are. You know, these techniques have names, right?
You're exactly right. None of this is an accident. It might just come off, you know, as somebody who's over the top and very outgoing and gregarious, but the reality is most of this is planned.
Sales techniques are really, they're a minor form of the con. And they have a lot of resemblance to it, but they're much more subtle, aren't they?
You're exactly right. They're a way to manipulate people to do what you want. In fact, they're very formulated, and they have names. Names like pouring on the honey, the puppy dog.
Pouring on the honey?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Pouring on the honey. That's where you're flattering someone. Like when we first started talking, you're telling them how smart they are, how great they look.
How good I looked, right?
That's exactly right. Okay. The Ben Franklin, the sharp angle, perceived scarcity.
Okay, well, hold on a second. Let's take some of these item by item. So perceived scarcity, I think I know what that means, but take us a little further on that.
Yeah, that's where someone is being pushed to buy something because there's a limited amount. Mm-hmm. For example, if you go into a store and you try on a new shirt and you kind of like it, but you're not sure, the salesperson may say, you know what, if you don't buy it now, it may be gone next time you come, so mm-hmm. you should buy it and then return it if you decide you don't want it later.
Yeah, so you got the 30-day free return, so that will help you make the decision now because if you feel like you made a mistake, you can always bring it back. But that gets the sale today.
That's exactly right. Okay. One of the more common ones that I see in the financial services industry is the now or never tied with the something for nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's the case where they come and they say, if you invest now, you'll get this bonus, the something for nothing. And if you don't do it by the next, you know, the end of the week or the end of the month, this offer goes away.
Yeah, you see that a lot in annuity sales. They'll give you like a 10% bonus and they'll use the scarcity of time or the now or never kind of thing because this deal only lasts until Friday.
That's exactly right. And one of the sneakier ones that I've seen and I've come across before is something called the assumptive close, and it comes in a lot of different formats.
Yeah.
You've probably run across it before. It's a situation where the salesperson is making you feel like you have already decided to buy, that you're going to have to go back and change their perception. You're going to disappoint them, for example.
Yeah. It would be awkward for you to kind of counter all the language that they're using that is assuming that you're going to close already. Now it's going to create an awkward situation.
That's exactly right. So, you know, a sneaky one that I saw was called the apology. It's where the salesperson would say, you know what, I'm really sorry that I didn't give you the contract to sign already. I know you're ready to sign.
Yeah.
So it's very awkward for you to then try to back up and say, no, I'm not ready to purchase.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of a book that I read when I first started out in the investment business over 30 years ago. I was, and to this day, remain a terrible salesman. So I thought when I started out, I would get a book. And this book was, you know, How to Sell to Anybody or something like that. And one of the things was you're sitting at the kitchen table with the prospect and you take out the application first and you put it on the table. Okay, there's nothing so bad with that. So they get used to seeing the application and it's not a shock when you bring it out when you're ready to close. But the thing that got me was he would take his pen out as well and he would have a clipboard. And subconsciously, he would tilt the clipboard up where the incline was toward the client on the other side, so the prospect on the other side of the table. And he would roll his pen down the clipboard toward the prospect while he was talking, a subconscious move. I have to tell you, right after that, I closed that book and I laughed so hard and I threw it in the garbage.
I mean, that's beyond, that is so dishonest trying to manipulate someone that way psychologically. I can't even fathom doing that.
So we get it. There's all of these techniques and there's so many ways to be manipulated. But really what you're talking about here is the imbalance of the power equation because of the imbalance of information. Let's talk about buying a car.
Yeah, that's a good example.
If you go and buy a car every 4 years or 6 years, some people don't buy a car for 8 or 10 years, you're then sitting across from the table who's someone who's selling cars day in and day out.
Yeah, they do this over and over 5 times a day or whatever every single day of their life. So they're very familiar with this process.
They've heard every objection.
Yes.
They know exactly what to say when. Mm-hmm. And there you are trying to just kind of buy the best car you can for a relatively decent price.
I would imagine most of these salespeople could create a whole decision tree with, if the customer says X, I say Y. It could almost be automated by a computer.
I mean, absolutely, absolutely. Let's go to a real life situation. What I'm talking about here is the steak dinner.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get these invitations in the mail. They're beautiful postcards, nice color, and they're offering a steak dinner to some fancy steakhouse in my community. And it's just to listen to a presentation. You kind of go, you go in there, you know you're going to be listening to a presentation. There's nothing, you don't get something for nothing.
That's right. And in fact, that is a technique in and of itself. It's called the obligation through reciprocity. I've done something nice for you. I've bought you a steak. Now you can sit here and listen to me sell you something.
Okay, fair enough. So let's go through the follow-up phone call the next day after the seminar. And why don't you take it?
Sure. So it'll probably go something
hang on. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Right. I brought a very technical device to the party here, and I brought a bell.
The Steve Pomerantz Show has props.
I have props now. It's like Jim Cramer, right? I'm going to get a horn. I'm going to get all... No, I'm simple. I have a bell. Uh-huh. And every time I hear one of these techniques, I'm going to ring the bell.
That sounds great.
Okay, so go.
So you may hear something like this. Hey, Steve, it's Rick. Thanks for coming to my steak dinner. You know, I'm really excited about the opportunity to work with you. How was the steak? Well, by the way, you asked one of the best questions last night.
Yeah. Well, the steak was really good, and thank you very much for that. I really want to hear about that product you were talking about that you made sound so good. So what was that product you spoke about the other night that made it sound so good?
Well, that was Product X, and as I said last night, it will grow your money in the stock market, protect your money at the same time, and give you a steady stream of income for the rest of your life so you never have to worry. Not only that, but because you came to my steak dinner, you're entitled to a free bonus if you sign up before Friday. And the good news is you get a 30-day free look so you can always change your mind.
Oh, gee. Oh, I don't know. It sounds really good, but I need to think about it.
Look, Steve, you know I'm a good guy. I'm invested in this, and so is my mother. And I wouldn't steer you wrong.
All right, Rick, all kidding aside. So what advice can we truly give to our listeners here?
You know, it's really important that they're paying attention to the conflicts of interest. The advice they're getting needs to be independent and objective. You need to make sure that the salesperson is looking out for you, not just trying to buy themselves a new boat. Take your time when making decisions. Don't be fooled by scarcity techniques, the technique of scarcity of time. Time is always available. These products are always available. You shouldn't feel like you're pushed to buy it today.
If there's a bonus that is going away on Friday, there's going to be another bonus Monday. And you know what? If you're making your decision based on a bonus, which you and I have talked about, by the way, when we've talked about some of these annuity products, this money, these bonuses, they don't come from nowhere. They come from your own pocket. They're just rearranging the shell game to front load it to make you buy in the front. So it's that extra bonus thing and it's the time thing, that's a good clue that you're really sitting down with the wrong person.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay.
You need to keep your antenna up for these manipulative techniques, especially in making financial decisions, because they can have a dramatic impact on the quality of your life down the road.
Yeah. You know, it's not like, you know, you're buying a bike or something like that. I mean, will last you a couple of years, a car. These decisions can be hazardous to the rest of your life if you make them poorly or you hook your star to the wrong company or the wrong person.
Yeah. So you need to take your time. Yeah. Again, you know, as you and I have talked about many times, making these kinds of decisions the first time you're introduced to it or the first day or when you're pushed to do it is often a bad idea.
Sleeping on it is always a good idea too. You know, you can also research the complaint history of a person you're talking with, especially in the advisory business. There are links available to get that info and we'll post them on the site. Check this out before you make the appointment. Because again, you want to kind of go in with as much information as possible or maybe not go in again. And as I said, you know, if you get suckered into buying the wrong car, you may be stuck for a few years, but this is one of the most important decisions that you'll make in your life. So the honest sales process should involve, number one, discovering what the client's needs are. You know, there's this old saying that if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
You're exactly
if you have
right.
one product to sell, let's say it's insurance, then every solution is an insurance solution because that's the only way you're going to make your living.
That's exactly it.
That's not the way the real world works. So it's very important to understand what the customer's needs are and to make sure that the solution actually fits those needs.
You're exactly right. You know, everything has pros and cons. You shouldn't buy something and think that this only is going to do great things for you. There's always downside. There's something like your illiquidity, you're locked in for a longer period of time.
Trade-offs.
You've got to pay attention to those.
Well, this is really entertaining and really informative. And I really thank you, Rick, for bringing this to us and look forward to our next segment.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a fun segment. Thanks.
And don't forget to hear this segment and any other segment or interview that we have. Or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website, stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, where we will list all the important topics about which we've spoke right into your inbox every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show was obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.